This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Thomas W. Samuels. Well, Mr. Samuels, I wasn't living in Decatur in 1974 when your book of memoirs, Lawyer in Action, was published, and I'll have to confess that I hadn't heard of it when I invited you to help on this project. But since then, I have read it, and I found it delightful reading, very uplifting and stimulating. Perhaps some people might think a recorded interview might not be necessary. Our listeners could just read your book. But I feel it would be very valuable for this series to have your comments in your own voice. So if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few questions. I know you haven't lived in Decatur all your life. When and where were you born?
I was born in Carrollton in Greene County, Illinois, on April 1, 1886, just a few days short of 95 years ago.
Oh, well, that has really been a wonderful life, hasn't it? Well, can you tell us something about your educational background?
I did my undergraduate work at the University of Illinois, and I studied law at Harvard and Illinois, graduating in 1914. Prior to entering the university, I was graduated from the East St. Louis High School, which incidentally, I think was the finest school I ever attended, despite the bad reputation that East St. Louis now has.
Well, that's high praise. Then, after you received your law degree, you came to Decatur. When was that? You said, I believe.
That was in the summer of 1914, just prior to the outbreak of the war.
Well, how did you happen to come to Decatur?
I knew of Decatur as a medium-sized, enterprising city, growing city, with many industries, good schools, good churches, a reputation for civic mindedness. In short, a good place to raise a family and practice law.
Well, I'm sure you haven't been disappointed. You've been here ever since, haven't you?
Yes. There was another reason that led me to come to Decatur. I had attended a trial in Champaign, a murder trial in Champaign, where Mr. Charles C. LaForgy was the chief counsel for the defendant, and I was very much impressed with his handling of that case, and I thought it would be wonderful if I could form some kind of an association, beginning association, with him. And that was one of the reasons why I came to Decatur, and I did apply for a job with him and got it, starting at $75 a month, which was a fair starting salary in those days, particularly when, in view of the fact that in October, when I was married, I was able to obtain a very nice five-room apartment on the corner of southeast corner of Decatur and Pine Street for $25 a month.
Well, that tells us a little bit about the circumstances of the city at that time, but maybe you'd like to tell us more about the kind of city Decatur was. From something about the streets or the administration?
Yes. Decatur was about 30,000, a city of about 30,000, as I recall. Physically, not all the streets were paved. The chief mode of transportation was streetcars, which ran pretty much over the City, west on West Main, north on Edward Street to the Wabash Depot, all centering at the Lincoln Square, where the transfer house, which is now located in Central Park, was located. If you were coming from, if you were coming east on West Main and wanted to go to the Wabash station, you got off at the transfer house, was given a transfer ticket, and then got on a streetcar for the Wabash station, all for a nickel. Indeed, you could travel all over the city for a nickel.
I believe you said the streets weren't all paved. Were they
no,
in pretty bad shape? But sometimes
many of the streets were dirt streets. The streets that were paved, such as West Main, East Main, Water Street, South Main, and North Main, were paved, generally, as I recall, with brick. Later, these streets were, or some of them at least, were paved with wood blocks. In wet weather, these blocks tended to expand and bulk up, bulge up, and they were taken up, and then the streets were these streets were paved with concrete and later blacktop.
What about the city officials and the administration? Well, you wanted to say more about the streets?
As I recall, Pershing Street was a dirt road, bounded on both sides, north and south, by farmland. What is now South Shores, a city in itself, was entirely a wooded area. The Interurban Railroad ran to Springfield, north to Bloomington and Peoria, and west to and east to Champaign, and was a very popular means of transportation. The Wabash, now the N&W Railroad, and the Illinois Central did a flourishing passenger business north to Chicago and south to St. Louis. There were no television in those days, no electric refrigerators. People had ice boxes into which the iceman dumped 25 or 50 pounds of ice once or twice a week. The market. There were no supermarkets, but many small grocery stores which made house-to-house deliveries. There were not many automobiles. I don't recall whether we had stop signs or not. There was no air conditioning. Very few women, if none that I can now recall, smoked cigarettes. There were cuspidors in most every office and building in the city. We had many good schools and many good churches, as I have mentioned before. Politically, the city was run by a city council, which was made up of aldermen elected from districts and presided over by a mayor elected at large. That system was subsequently changed, as you know, and we now have a city commission, the commissioners being elected at large. Dan Dineen was mayor of Decatur at the time, when I came to Decatur. Woodrow Wilson was president. Thomas Riley Marshall was vice president. William Jennings Bryan was Secretary of State, and Charles M. Borchers, father of Weber Borchers, was then mayor of Decatur. As I recall, James Hamilton Lewis was our United States Senator. The courthouse, our present courthouse, had not been built. The Decatur Memorial Hospital had not been built. The Masonic Temple had not been built. We didn't have General Electric. We didn't have Caterpillar. We didn't have BorgWarner. We didn't have parking lots as such, and we didn't have zoning laws at that time. Hard roads were just coming into existence. I think that Route 2 and 10 were not completed until sometime in the 20s. Farmers opposed, many farmers opposed hard roads, as they do on the grounds that they consume too much good farmland. An objection that is has been carried over to other improvements. We didn't have the Staley Viaduct at that time, and we didn't have the Lake Decatur, nor did we.
Well, you have mentioned Lake Decatur and the dam. Maybe you could tell us why the dam was built and what led to the building. Of course, that led to the building of the lake, didn't it?
Yes. The Staley Company had come to Decatur, had been established in Decatur just a year or two before, just a few years before I came. They immediately began using large quantities of water in their manufacturing process. It soon became obvious that we had to supply larger quantities of water or lose the Staley Company. In fact, the late Mr. Staley Sr. Purchased a large tract of land on the river near Peoria with the view to moving the plant to there. Leaders in Decatur saw the problem and organized the Decatur Water Supply Company and issued stock. The proceeds of the sale of stock were used in large part for the building of the dam and the construction of the lake. Prior to the building of the Lake Decatur, Staley and the city obtained water from the Sangamon River, which was just a small sluggish stream, particularly in the summer months. I think that Staley at its own expense built, the Staley Company at its own expense built a small dam, but it was totally inadequate, and so later came the larger dam and Lake Decatur, which has of course been a great blessing to our city, and which unquestionably has saved the Staley Company for Decatur.
And also, you were telling us about the Staley Viaduct. What brought that about?
Where the Staley Viaduct now is was a street, that is, but beneath the viaduct, was a street which ran north and south through the Staley property and through the and over the Wabash tracks. This divided the Staley property very awkwardly, and it was very difficult to go back and forth, for the employees to go back and forth and move products back and forth over that street. And it became clear, and it was dangerous for traffic to cross the Wabash tracks. So it became clear that there would have to be some kind of an overpass or viaduct. The city of Decatur and the township line, running east and west, divided across the Staley property, so that the south half of the what is now the viaduct was in the city of Decatur, and the north half was in, or the northern part of it was in, the township of Decatur. The four parties involved got together, namely the Staley Company, the City of Decatur, the Wabash Railroad Company, and the Township of Decatur, and began working on a contract to for the construction of a viaduct. It fell to my lot to represent the Staley Company in this undertaking. The City of Decatur was represented by its then Corporation Counsel, Lee Boland. The Wabash Railroad Company was represented by Mr. N.S. Brown, then the General Solicitor of the Wabash. I don't recall who represented the Township of Decatur. But as we worked along, and about the time we were ready to conclude the, finish the contract and submit it for signatures, and I might add here that all four parties were to contribute in certain proportions to the cost. Mr. Boland, who was a good lawyer, but who was known as having a tendency to find objections to anything that was wanted to be done, came up with a very unique objection. He pointed out that the dividing line between the township and the city bisected the viaduct. And that would mean that the city could only build a half a bridge. And he said he could find no authority in the statutes for that authorized a city to build a half a bridge, and certainly not to pay for a part of a bridge in the township. He said that would be like paying for a part of a bridge in Indiana. But it was an interesting point, and and caused some pause. I pointed out that Thomas Jefferson had serious doubts about his authority to purchase the Louisiana Territory. But nevertheless, he buried his objections and proceeded to perform the act. And I suggested that we do likewise, which we did. And viaduct was completed sometime in the 40s, as I recall, and I never heard of any legal, any objections to the legality or to the wisdom of the undertaking.
And they were able to pay for the whole bridge,
yes,
and
the four
finish
parties, the four parties paid for the
whole bridge.
For the viaduct. In later years, the city vacated that portion of the street underlying the viaduct, so that the Staley Company, having owned both sides of the street, became the owner of the vacated street.
And the viaduct is a city street.
It's a
state route too, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, that was the very satisfactory conclusion to that problem. when you came in 1914, you were right in the, we were in World War I, weren't we?
Yes, not yet. It was in the mid-June of that year when the Archduke Francis Ferdinand of Austria was shot by a Bosnian Serb, and that in turn led to Austria-Hungary declaring war on Serbia. And this was followed almost immediately by Germany declaring war on Russia. We didn't get into the war until 1917,
right,
as I recall.
Right. But was Decatur affected by the war?
Oh, yes. The whole country was. It was a very tense time.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell us something about the end of the war in 1918.
Well, there was an unbelievable amount of joy, jubilation, singing, marching, just an outburst of joy and gratitude, happiness, the end of an awful struggle which had cost the lives of many Decatur boys.
So it was a very joyous time.
Indescribably so.
Yeah. Human relations are very important to a city, and I believe you were on the Human Relations Committee. Could you tell us something about that?
Yes, I served on that commission for a time. The movement of greater, providing greater respect and greater privileges for the black race was just getting underway. And
excuse me, could you tell us about what time that was? Was that in the, say, 1940s or 50s? Or
I forgot.
About that time.
Yes, I think so.
Right.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten exactly.
Well, that's... Understand.
Well, we used our offices to build a better ethnic climate indicator, and I think to some degree we succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we got in touch with all the employers of Decatur to determine what, if they were employing blacks and if they could find their way to employ more blacks. And I think we made the people of Decatur conscious,
mm-hmm,
of the problem as they had not been,
mm-hmm,
before.
Well, you've already mentioned Staley's. What were some of the other leading manufacturing firms in the city?
There was the Baird Harvester Company, Chambers Bearing Quinlan Company, who had their plant on North Jasper Street, Combination Fountain Company on East Division Street. They manufactured, this company manufactured soda fountains and refrigerators. The Decatur Brick Manufacturing Company on North Park Street. The Decatur Bridge Company, later known as the Mississippi Valley Structural Steel Company, located at corner of El Dorado and the CH&D Railroad. Decatur Coffin Company on North Morgan Street. The Decatur Foundry Company on North Laubert Street. The Decatur Ice Cream Company on North Edward. The Decatur Lumber and Manufacturing Company in the 600 block on North Water. The Decatur Manufacturing Company on East North, the Ferries Manufacturing Company on East Grand Street, Field and Shorb on West William, Clint Eaton and Company, manufacturers of pharmaceuticals, located on East Main Street, Irwin Neisler and Company, also in pharmaceuticals, on North Franklin, Mueller, H. Mueller and Company on West Cerro Gordo, Mullenbrook Glove and Mitten Company in the 300 block on North Main, J.G. Starr and Sons Harness Company on North Broadway, Stevens Manufacturing and Foundry Company on East Cerro Gordo, the Union Iron Works in the 600 block of East William Street, and the Walrus Manufacturing Company on the southeast corner of Broadway and Wabash.
Well, that's an impressive list.
Yes.
Decatur's always been industrialized.
Yes.
Well, what was the financial climate of the city, Mr. Samuels?
I'd say that it was good. Taxes were low. We had no sales taxes. The income tax law had just come into effect in 1913 and was comparatively insignificant. The rate, as I recall, was only 1% on the first 20,000. In other words, 20,000 of net income, which was a good deal in those days, was exempt from the tax. Today, of course, there's scarcely any transaction of any that doesn't have tax implications. We had no, as I mentioned before, we had no zoning laws to contend with. We had no labor laws, no environmental laws. None of the problems that consume so much of a businessman's time today.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, your profession was law. How has the practice of law changed over the years?
It has become much more complex and much more specialized. As I mentioned before, tax law was very simple. There was no labor laws. There were no. We didn't have the Securities Act to contend with, which we have today. In the early days, the rule was caveat emptor, let the purchaser beware. Today, the rule is let the seller beware. When Lincoln practiced law, his library consisted of about six books. Today, a library that of necessary size will consume six to eight thousand books. Every 2 years, the legislature turns out some 2,000 or 3,000 pages of new laws. Much of it is ill-considered, overlapping, and confusing. By the time the courts get it construed, we get another batch. Same goes for Congress. So that the and in addition to that, the courts of last resort turn out over 60,000 decisions, final decisions a year, so that the sheer task of finding the law today requires hard work. What was the name of your law firm when you came to Decatur?
What was the name of your law firm when you came to Decatur, Mr. Samuels?
Laforge, Vail, and Miller. Robert Vail was a fine lawyer, the son of the late Circuit Judge Edward P. Vail. Philip Miller was an Easterner, a graduate of Harvard Law School, and a protege of Felix Frankfurter, who later became a Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Miller, Philip Miller, was the first of three Millers in our firm. The second Miller was Charles Y. Miller, who became circuit judge in Macon County. And the third Miller is Carl R. Miller, who is a senior partner in our present firm of Samuels, Miller, Schroeder, Jackson, and Sly.
Well, who are some of the people you recall as important to the city?
There were many. Of course, there was A.E. Staley, founder of the Staley Company, Howard Shaw of the Decatur Review, Frank Lindsay of the Decatur Herald, both of which papers were later consolidated into one, O.B. Gorin, president of the Millikan National Bank, Mr. Merriweather, I've forgotten his first name, president of the National Bank of Decatur, Mr. Corbett, president of the Citizens National Bank. Later, Andrew Kenny, president of the Citizens National Bank. In those days, there were just three banks in Decatur, the Citizens National Bank, the Millikan National Bank, and the National Bank of Decatur. Later in there was the Farmers and Merchants State Bank, located on East Main Street, where the Savings and Loan Building now is. That bank failed in the mid-1920s. There, of course, was Mr. Clay Dempsey of the Union Iron Works, William J. Grady of the Ferries Company, Ed Blank, I'll have to fill that name, T.T. Roberts, Adolph Mueller, and many others.
Well, who were some of the leaders of the bar at that time?
I would say that Hugh Cray was the leader of the bar at that time. Incidentally, it was said that Hugh Cray would have been named to the Supreme Court of the United States had James G. Blaine been elected president of the United States. I would name Charles C. LaForgie, Hugh Housum, his partner, Ike Mills, who had just died shortly before I came, Andrew Mills, Walter Mills, Robert Vail, Ralph Monroe,
Thomas Samuels,
and others that I no, Thomas Samuels was not a leader then, if ever. Incidentally, every lawyer at the bar when I came here, and every lawyer living at that time in Springfield, Clinton, and Champaign, is dead.
Oh.
I've survived them all.
That's distinction. Do you have any recommendations for young people today?
I don't think so. I often feel sorry for the young people of today who are pushed around, pulled and battered by so many distractions, rock and roll, basketball, automobiles, football. I don't know how they get any work done. I I wonder what would have happened, or what kind of a man Lincoln would have become mm-hmm. if he had been subjected to all the distractions of modern youth.
Mm-hmm. So you think it isn't easy being a young person today?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do think. I do think that.
But
although I'd like to be one of them.
You wouldn't mind starting over again?
No.
Well, great.
No, knowing what I know now.
Great. Mr. Samuels, we certainly want to thank you for sharing your reminiscences with us. It's really been inspiring to take a look back over your very long and productive life and all the many contributions that you have made to Decatur. And we want to thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to hear the comments that you have made for us today. You have been listening to Mr. Thomas W. Samuels giving us his memoirs and impressions of his life in Decatur. And this is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library.